Is there anything more important than taking care of yourself? Everybody knows that when you're not feeling the best, you can't be your best. Well, that's where Sambucol comes in. Sambucol makes you feel better with powerful immune support, powered by nature's super fruit, the black elderberry. There's been a handful of mornings where I've woken up feeling rubbish, and Sambucol has given me that control back by supporting my immune system and making me feel better. It's not a chore to take Sambucol either because it tastes amazing, and my personal favourite is the syrups, but the gummies are wonderful as well. It's easy to incorporate Sambucol into your wellness routine. I personally take Sambucol each morning with my breakfast. Get 15% off your next order of $9.99 or more at sambucolusa.com. Use the promo code MORBID15 for 15% off. Look, let's be real. We need to take better care of our teeth, especially over the festive period. I know for me personally, I eat enough candy for 20 people. Well, that's where Quip comes in. The Quip electric toothbrush is loved by over 7 million people. It has a lightweight and sleek design for adults and children, time sonic vibrations with 30-second pulses, a multi-use travel cover, reusable handles, and more. Quip offers lots of other products to make sure your mouth is in tip-top shape, including floss, refillable sugar-free gum, refillable mouthwash, and more. If you go to getquip.com/morbidology right now, on top of their holiday savings, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free and up to 40% off bundles at getquip.com/morbidology. That is spelled getquip.com/morbidology. Quip, the good habits company. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. In early 2018, an inmate at Santa Fe County Jail heard some grisly details from a fellow inmate. It was a confession. A confession that her son had been murdered. Rumours in jail and prison can be rife, but an investigation would uncover that this was certainly more than just a rumour. It was January of 2018 when an inmate in a Santa Fe County jail in New Mexico informed a guard of something she had heard, a potential homicide. She revealed that 35-year-old Tracy Ann Pena had spoken about finding her son dead at home and blamed her boyfriend, 42-year-old Thomas Wayne Ferguson, for causing his death. At the time, both Tracy and Thomas were in jail for probation violations. Thomas had been on probation after pleading guilty to kidnapping and aggravated battery of a family member back in 2014, while Tracy was on probation after pleading guilty in August to attempting to tamper with evidence, which was in relation to concealing cocaine. Rumours in jail are rife, but authorities decided that they would investigate. This was a very serious crime that somebody was confessing to after all, and as it turned out, Tracy certainly did have a son, 13-year-old Jeremiah Valencia. Investigators would listen in on a phone call between Tracy and Thomas, during which Tracy said that she had been crying about the Hedo, When Tracy was interviewed about her son by investigators, she claimed that Jeremiah had simply run away from home and she didn't know where he was. However, she would eventually confess that on the 26th of November, she had just gotten out of jail for a previous charge. And when she returned to the home she shared with Thomas on New Mexico 503, she found Jeremiah dead. She claimed that he was wrapped up in a blanket on the bed. According to Tracy, she confronted Thomas. She claimed he grabbed Jeremiah's body, put it in his car, and sped off. When asked why she didn't call police, Tracy said that she was so scared of Thomas, that he had abused Jeremiah in the past, and that she strongly believed that Thomas had murdered Jeremiah. She also claimed that sometime later, Thomas drove her to a location just off New Mexico 503 near Nambi and informed her that he had buried Jeremiah nearby. With a potential gravesite, investigators embarked on the scene located off New Mexico 503, just north of Santa Fe. They were taken to the specific area by Tracy. With the assistance of a cadaver dog, investigators found a suspected burial site that had been somewhat sloppily concealed by tree branches. They would unearth a small body stuffed inside a plastic storage bin. Sergeant Richard Matthews would announce the grim discovery to the public.
Where we were looking, we found our victim, and that was hard. These things stay with you, especially when you recognize everything you've been told.
Thomas and Tracy would be charged with child abuse resulting in death, tampering with evidence, and conspiracy to commit tampering with evidence. However, these weren't the only arrests in the case. It would shortly be announced that Thomas's own son, 19-year-old Jordan Anthony Nunez, had been arrested and charged with the same things. Back when the search for Jeremiah's body was being conducted, investigators had spoken with Jordan. He first of all stated that he had just recently reconnected with his father back in October, after being away from one another for around a year. He said that a few days later, his father then took Jeremiah to live with a family member in Mora. Investigators then spoke with Jeremiah's 13-year-old sister, who informed them that Jeremiah had been living in Mora with a family member. However, she then said that Jeremiah was at the family's home on the 6th of December for a birthday party, but this was the date that Tracy had claimed Thomas had driven her out to show her where Jeremiah was buried. It was quite evident that the family had been colluding to try and come up with some kind of cover story, but that cover story was crumbling to pieces. Jeremiah's sister would eventually admit that she had been told by Thomas that if anybody asked about Jeremiah, to just say that he was staying in Mora with family. When Thomas was interviewed by investigators, he had essentially blamed his own son for Jeremiah's death. He claimed that Jeremiah and Jordan had been playing aggressively when Jeremiah died, adding that he didn't think to call the police or call for an ambulance, out of fear that he would be blamed. He said he didn't know where Jeremiah had been buried, but said that he knew who had buried the body. He refused to identify this person. By this point in the investigation, Jordan had changed his version of events. He now claimed that on the night that Jeremiah had died, his father had punched him in the face and stomach numerous times and said that Jeremiah was bleeding. He said that his father then dragged Jeremiah into a back room of the house, locked the door behind him, and started to play really loud music so nobody could hear what was going on inside the room. He said that his father then told him that if anybody ever asked where Jeremiah was, to tell them that he was with an uncle in Mora. He claimed that he also put padlocks on all of the doors of the home to ensure that nobody could leave. Tracy would also change her version of events when presented with the other versions of events that investigators had received. While she had first of all claimed that Thomas disposed of Jeremiah's body when she returned home from jail, she now claimed that Jeremiah's body was actually kept hidden away in the garage for 3 days before Thomas and Jordan wrapped him in the plastic sheeting and then stuffed him into a plastic storage box. She told investigators that she, Thomas and Jordan, then drove down New Mexico 503 to the area where they then buried his body. Santa Fe County Sheriff Robert Garcia would hold a press conference following the charges to provide a grim update in the case. He struggled to hold back tears as he revealed that Jeremiah had endured years of abuse, neglect, and even torture.
Although I've seen a lot, this is very gut-wrenching.
It's hard to sleep at night just thinking about the abuse this poor child went through. This poor child suffered at the hands of a monster.
When Jeremiah's younger sister was interviewed, she disturbingly revealed that Jeremiah would frequently be beaten by Thomas, sometimes so brutally that he needed to use a cane to walk or use a wheelchair. Sheriff Garcia described the case as gruesome and heartbreaking, and said that Jeremiah would be forced to sleep inside a locked dog kennel. He stated, "I can honestly say that this poor child suffered at the hands of a monster." Jeremiah's 13-year-old sister said that on the day that Jeremiah had died, Thomas had begun punching him in the living room, and then dragged him into the kitchen and into the bathroom where the attack continued. She said that after the brutal beating, Jeremiah was put back in the dog kennel, and she suggested that Jeremiah probably died alone in the dog kennel after the attack. After realizing that he was dead, she said that Thomas and Jordan then moved his body into the bedroom. She further told investigators that her mother knew about the dog kennel, and when Thomas wasn't around, she would sneak her son water. By this point, Jeremiah's autopsy had not yet been completed, so his cause of death was not yet known, nor were the extent of his injuries. But that would come with the autopsy report. Sheriff Garcia would state during a press conference, "In my years in law enforcement, I would think that this is one of the most terrifying types of investigations that I've seen. Although I've seen a lot, this is very gut-wrenching, to the point where you go home and it's hard to sleep at night, just thinking about the abuses the poor child went through." The murder of Jeremiah was exceptionally disturbing, from the manner of death to the fact that nobody even noticed that Jeremiah was missing. As it transpired, Jeremiah hadn't been enrolled in school. The last time that he was enrolled in the district was when he was a sixth grader back in 2015, and this was the last time he attended school. Santa Fe District Attorney Mark Osina would state in the media, "I am sickened by this horrific tragedy. We are a close-knit community and this touches so many of our families. I want Northern New Mexicans to know that this case is of the highest priority and I will do everything in my power to seek justice for this innocent child. We are in the very early stages of this tragedy, so tonight I ask all of New Mexico to pray for our community." Jeremiah was described by the family's neighbors as a quiet boy who loved playing with his dogs. His neighbor, Al Martinez, said that sometimes he saw Jeremiah in the yard with his sister, but said that he mostly remained silent. However, he would always say hello, but that was about the extent of the conversation that he got out of him. The family had a litter of puppies in the summer beforehand, and Al recollected how he always saw Jeremiah playing with them, adding that it appeared as though he was in love with the puppies, and they were his best friends. While the family had neighbours, they were isolated. When they moved in, Thomas installed a chain-link fence to separate themselves from the rest of the street. Al would state, "I think about that, how little interaction there was with his family. There were never any other people." The family home hadn't seen any life until Jeremiah's body was found. Now, people came by hourly to leave flowers, trinkets, and letters of condolences for a boy who had seemingly lived a life of loneliness and pain. Jeremiah's grandfather, Rick Tapia, said that he loved playing music and mechanically tinkering. At one point in time, Rick had been appointed by the court as Jeremiah's temporary guardian. He said that while in his care, Jeremiah enjoyed playing the trumpet and taking things apart to put them back together again. Rick had cared for Jeremiah and his sister in 2011, following a state Children, Youth and Families Department investigation into the family, which had raised concerns about the children's care. These custody arrangements lasted for a year before Jeremiah and his sister were returned to their mother. This wasn't the first time that Tracy had given up Jeremiah and his sister. In 2008, Rick and his wife had petitioned for guardianship of Jeremiah and his sister, and Tracy would sign off on the agreement, writing, "I do not want to cause any more destruction in the children's lives." Both Tracy and Thomas had lengthy criminal records, while Jordan had been awaiting trial on a battery case from back in December. Tracy had pleaded guilty to no contest a number of times since 2009 for a variety of charges, including shoplifting, attempted shoplifting, criminal trespass, and attempt to commit a felony with a possession of a controlled substance. She had been booked into the Santa Fe County Jail a total of 22 times. Thomas had 20 years worth of charges, including counts relating to kidnapping, domestic abuse, abandonment or abuse of a child, and a charge of criminal sexual penetration that would be dropped as part of a plea agreement. In 1996, he had served probation for a drug charge, and when he violated this probation, he served 6 months in jail. In 2001, he was sentenced again to probation for shoplifting. In 2003, Thomas had been found guilty of battery on his wife at the time, Amanda Ferguson, in Santa Fe. In this case, Thomas had knocked Amanda down, punched her in the head, choked her until she fell unconscious, and then kicked her in the upper torso and upper back.
Where did Mr. Ferguson hit you?
My face.
Did he hit you in the mouth at all?
Yes. He would push me away or he backhand me like that.
During his trial for this case, a doctor testified about the injuries on Amanda.
I noted some abrasions to the left side of her face and forehead, a contusion to the right forehead, contusion to the right face, an inner lower lip laceration, a contusion to the left jaw, two contusions on the front part of the neck.
A paramedic would also testify that at the time of the attack, Amanda had been pregnant and holding their baby. She would describe the injuries that the attack had on the baby.
I noticed that she had two hematomas on her head. When I pointed him out to her, she said that her husband did that when he was assaulting her.
Thomas was sentenced to unsupervised probation for 6 months on the condition that he attend court-ordered counselling. Then 3 years later, while living in Texas, he was charged with obstruction. In 2014, Thomas was indicted on felony charges of criminal sexual penetration, kidnapping, aggravated battery against a household member, and interference with communications. In this case, Thomas had kept his longtime girlfriend, who was not Tracy, at his home for 5 days, during which he beat and sexually assaulted her. The woman was able to contact her mother, who in turn contacted police. While in jail on this charge, Thomas's public defender filed a motion to review his release conditions, and in this motion, he wrote that since his arrest, Thomas had been studying anger management and codependency issues. The prosecutor replied, stating that the $250,000 bond was reasonable, given how violent the crime was and his prior convictions. He wrote, "The evidence was presented in support of his detention includes the fact that defendant was convicted for a similar series of crimes in Texas and violated his parole in that case by acquiring these new charges. His behaviour shows a disregard for the court-ordered conditions of release, parole, and the law in general." According to the prosecutor, Thomas had actually attempted to kill himself as opposed to be arrested for the attack on his girlfriend. When police had arrived to arrest him, he had taken an overdose on prescription medication. Then in 2015, Thomas had reached a plea agreement in which he pleaded guilty to kidnapping and aggravated battery against the girlfriend. The plea agreement stipulated that his conviction be classified as non-violent. He would be sentenced to 10 years and 8 months in prison, but then the judge suspended almost 7 years and 8 months of the sentence and credited Thomas with 495 days for the days he had already spent in jail. He was released on 5 years of supervised probation and was ordered to be on an electric monitor for 2 years. In February of 2016, a prosecutor filed a motion to have Thomas's probation revoked after a probation officer went to his home and found his girlfriend, who wasn't Tracy, had evident signs of battery. Thomas would admit that he had violated the probation by having negative contact with police. The judge would allow Thomas to remain on probation despite the fact he had violated it, and despite his probation officer's recommendation that he serve out the remainder of his sentence in jail. Then on the 20th of November 2018, around a week before Jeremiah was killed, a deputy district attorney would file another motion to revoke Thomas's probation. In this motion, he referred to Thomas as an absconder for failing to report to his probation officer in June and for failing to follow court orders for requesting permission to move homes. The fact that Thomas had such a lengthy criminal record but was walking free raised many questions, with State Police Chief Pete Casetas stating, "How many times in this state do we give individuals a second, third, fourth and fifth chance? After 25 years of doing this, it's just frustrating. The system needs to be looked at. We need to find out why this guy was out, quite frankly."
And we have to ask ourselves, why are these evil people in our community walking around with the rest of us?
The sister of Thomas's victim in the 2014 case said that Thomas was smart when it came to picking who he dated, stating that he picked those who were vulnerable, those who had children, or those who had a criminal background, and then he used that to manipulate and control them. She stated, "Me and him never saw eye to eye because I'm a strong woman. He doesn't like strong women." For dry January and beyond, there's no better time to try Shirley. They offer craft, great-tasting wines that don't compromise your health or come feeling rubbish the next day. Shirley works with a talented team of winemakers to bring you amazing de-alcoholized wines that fit any lifestyle, whether you're wanting to be healthier or just cut down on your alcohol. With Shirley, you can wake up with a clear head and a happy mind. Gone are the days of rubbish sleep and low productivity that often comes after drinking alcohol. You can swap your after-work glass of wine for Shirley or bring a bottle to a friend's house and see the difference. Head on over to hishirley.com/morbidology. That is hishirley.com/morbidology and use the code morbidology for 20% off your first order. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and their today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counselor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Back in 2015 in Santa Fe, Thomas had pleaded guilty to kidnapping and aggravated battery, and after his release, he faced up to 9 years if he violated his probation. And violate his probation, he certainly did. When less than a year later, he was arrested again for attacking another woman. It was either a miscommunication or a lack of communication between prosecutors in Rio Rancho and Santa Fe, which resulted in Thomas not being rearrested and sent back to prison. According to prosecutor Natalie Perry, she was told that the Rio Rancho case would not proceed while the staff at the prosecutor's office in Santa Fe were unaware that Thomas had pleaded guilty in the Rio Rancho case. This meant that at the time that Jeremiah was killed, Thomas really should have been in prison, because that guilty plea was essentially Thomas admitting that he had violated his probation. Furthermore, the New Mexico Probation and Parole Division had an address for Thomas when he stopped checking in with his probation officer and was deemed an absconder from the law. They went to check on him at the home he shared with Tracy. They knocked on the door and nobody answered, so they simply just left. They didn't leave any paperwork announcing that they had visited, and they never checked back again. If the New Mexico Probation and Parole Division had have checked back when somebody was home, there was every chance that they could uncover what was happening to Jeremiah behind that closed door. Just a few days after Jeremiah's body was unearthed, dozens of locals gathered for a candlelight vigil. Pictures of Jeremiah were placed on a makeshift altar, which was placed in front of the playground at the Nambe Community Centre. Katrina Hernandez, who had organised the vigil, said, before those in attendance, "We just wanted to do something to support the family during this difficult time. As a community, we feel for him and we feel for the family." The vigil began with a recording of Amazing Grace while prayers were recited. Jeremiah had been the third community member to be the victim of a violent death in the recent years, and those in attendance called on the community to do better. One woman stated, "This child had no one. We need to recognise that. We also need to recognise that we all had some kind of responsibility in it." The woman said that she had driven past the unassuming home on numerous occasions, completely oblivious to the horrors that were unfolding behind that front door.
"He went through hell. Yes, he did. But you know what? Right now, he's here with us. And he's smiling down at us. That's our guardian angel. And he's going to stand up and he's going to protect every other kid that this is happening to.
Yes.
It's going to stop.
These children need to stop dying. It's awful. I've seen this on the news. It's every day, it's happening to one of our children. They're putting him in the ground. There are angels. These children don't know any better.
Jeremiah may have lost his life, but he's going to give life to a hell of a lot of kids.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
His death will not be in vain."
The case really hit home for one person in attendance, Andrew Valdez, whose three-year-old son, Leland, who had been the victim of a child abuse murder at the hands of his mother's boyfriend. He stated, "It's happening way too often in this state. Something needs to be done, and it needs to be done now." One woman in attendance said that she had grown up with Tracy, and revealed that on one occasion, Tracy had called her up and asked her for help getting out of her violent relationship with Thomas. The woman said, "She was afraid of this man." Another person in attendance, Bert Gonzalez, reiterated a similar story, revealing that Tracy had called his eldest daughter, who she used to go to school with, and asked her for help leaving Thomas. Some children who had attended school with Jeremiah in the past were in attendance. Savannah Molina said that she and Jeremiah had been the best friends while in school. She described him as a very sweet and caring person, and said that she and his other friends had wondered where he was when he stopped coming to school. Tracy, Thomas, and Jordan were all hoping to receive bail, but the Santa Fe District Attorney's Office would file a petition to keep them behind bars until they went to trial. The petition would state that Thomas had admitted to punching Jeremiah in the face after he said something. Afterwards, he took him into a back room, shut the door, and brutalized him. The petition read in part, "Ferguson choked the victim, holding him against a wall. Ferguson then turned the victim upside down and slammed the victim's head into the ground several times." The petition also revealed that Jordan had told investigators that Jeremiah would not be fed while in the dog kennel, and that Thomas would punish him by hitting his fingers with a hammer. Inside the shed at the home, investigators had found a hammer, which fit the description provided by Jordan, alongside a wheelchair that Jeremiah had to use because of the prolonged abuse. They also found blood on a carpet where it was believed that Jeremiah was beaten to death by Thomas. The petition wrote that while Tracy wasn't there when the fatal beating had taken place, she knew that he had been subjected to months of abuse and torture, and had failed to act or protect her son. It read in part, "The defendant was more concerned about her outstanding arrest warrants and law enforcement contact than she was with the well-being and protection of her 13-year-old son." It would also be revealed that investigators had found Facebook messages from Jordan, who had said that if Tracy ratted him out, then he would murder her too. Jordan would actually provide more gruesome details about what Jeremiah had endured before his murder. He said that Thomas would often beat Jeremiah with brass knuckles, a cane, a homemade spear, a 5-pound hammer, and steel-toe boots. He had also been forced to wear an adult diaper and had been forbidden from using the bathroom. He said that Thomas frequently urinated on Jeremiah and would use the homemade spear to choke him. According to Jordan, there were at least two occasions where he thought that Jeremiah was going to die while being choked by Thomas. On these occasions, Thomas would push the spear to Jeremiah's neck and lift him up against a wall, completely cutting off his air supply. Speaking about the day that Jeremiah died, Jordan said that his father had punched him in the face with such force that he thought that Jeremiah's teeth had been knocked out before his head was slammed repeatedly off the floor. Seemingly wanting to distance himself from the murder, Jordan then claimed that his father had pointed a shotgun at his head and forced him to help him move Jeremiah's body from the dog kennel to the bedroom. In the wake of Jeremiah's murder, many would call for New Mexico's child abuse laws to be changed, including one that would make intentional child abuse resulting in death a first-degree felony, which would be punishable by a life sentence, regardless of the child's age. At the time, the law was limited to victims 12 years old and under, which quite frankly made no sense. A child of 13 years old would be no more able to defend themselves than a child of 12 years old or younger. Lawmakers would advance this bill by the 1st of February, and it would next go to the House Judiciary Committee. Some people who opposed it said that a blanket change could result in a juvenile who kills another juvenile being sent to life in prison. However, Representative Sarah Mae Estes Barnes, who put the bill forward, said that a grand jury would not consider a juvenile killing a juvenile child abuse. As mentioned, Jeremiah had not been enrolled in school at the time of his death, and this raised many questions as to how this wasn't flagged. According to West Las Vegas School District, Jeremiah and his sister had been enrolled in the district in the fall of 2016, but in February of 2017, they were both withdrawn from school by Tracy. According to Santa Fe Public Schools, Tracy had begun paperwork to enroll Jeremiah and his sister at Capshaw Middle School in March of 2017. This was around the time that Tracy, Thomas and the two children moved from Las Vegas to Santa Fe. However, the paperwork to enroll them in the school was never actually completed, and the two children simply fell off the radar. If Jeremiah and his sister had been enrolled in school in Santa Fe, then it would have been the school's policy to investigate where they were when they never showed up to school. At Santa Fe Public Schools, staff are required to make at least 5 attempts to make contact when a child is absent from school, and then a record of these absences are kept on file. Jeremiah had earlier been enrolled in Santa Fe Public Schools, but the family had moved to Las Vegas for some time, and he was then enrolled there. When they returned to Santa Fe, Tracy simply didn't complete the enrollment process. Between 2015 and 2016, Jeremiah had been enrolled at Carlos Gilbert Elementary School, and they would post a tribute for him. As they said, "Once you're a Blackhawk, you're always a Blackhawk." They said that Jeremiah had made friends easily and had always been very polite, friendly, fun-loving, and extremely hard-working. He was athletic and adored playing sports, mostly basketball. In fact, he had once said that he dreamed of becoming a professional basketball player. It was at this school that Jeremiah had learned to play the trumpet and was a member of the school band. One teacher said, "He knew he belonged here and was happy to be a part of our community." Jeremiah was well-liked and known as a fun kid to play and joke with, and he wanted to learn as much as he could in school. Jeremiah also wasn't afraid to ask for help when he needed it in school, whether that be from his fellow classmates or from his teacher. Those who knew him in school said that when he received that help, he was always very gracious and always made sure to say thank you. He was such a kind boy that he made sure to open doors for teachers and even hug them. His teacher said that despite his young age, it was clear he had a strong moral compass. If he made a mistake, he would apologise and then learn from it. One teacher said, "If any child would step up to stand with or protect others, it was Jeremiah. He was a kind and loyal friend to his classmates." On the 7th of February, Jeremiah was laid to rest. Before the funeral procession, his family went to the Rivera Family Funeral Home, where an employee explained how the mass was going to proceed. He told the family to place their hands on the casket, telling them, "Go ahead and leave your handprint on the casket. like Jeremiah, left his handprint on all of your lives. The casket was then blessed by a priest and led down the aisle of St. Anthony of Padua Catholic Church. Hundreds of people packed into the church to celebrate the life of Jeremiah and to mourn his passing. At the front of the church were photographs of Jeremiah, smiling, during a much happier time in his life. His family would recollect some fond memories, such as how Jeremiah loved being outside, especially camping and fishing. They recalled how he loved building things and how he had a very close bond with his sister. Reverend Vincent Dominic said before a crowd, he tried to make other kids happy. He was a suffering kid, but he was trying to make other kids happy because he knew what it was to be unhappy. Following the service, Jeremiah was buried in St. Anthony's Parish Cemetery. Among those in attendance were the investigators who had been working on the case. In front of his grave, Jeremiah was blessed while balloons were released into the sky. As the casket was lowered into the ground, the song See You Again by Charlie Puth and Wiz Khalifa played out on a radio. As 2022 begins, I've already started to think about my New Year's resolutions. My main one is to take better care of myself and my skin. Skincare is super important to me, and that's why I'm excited to be working with the amazing Apostrophe, whether it be breakouts, those telltale signs of aging, or even wanting to even your skin tone. Apostrophe will help achieve that glowing skin we're all searching for. Apostrophe is a prescription skincare company that offers science-backed oral and topical medications that are clinically proven to help clear acne. They connect you with a board-certified dermatologist who will create a personalized treatment plan that is perfectly tailored to your unique skin. You just fill in the online quiz, take a selfie, and you will get your customized plan. It really couldn't be any easier to get set up and get the professional help that you're looking for, and they even treat all types of acne. For me personally, I needed a better morning routine and something to help target those wrinkle-prone areas. My dermatologist on Apostrophe got me set up with a gentle cleanser morning and night, a moisturiser, and an Apostrophe topical cream. We have a special deal for our Morbidology listeners. Save $15 off your first visit with an Apostrophe provider at apostrophe.com/morbidology when you use the code Morbidology. This code is only available for our listeners. To get started, go to apostrophe.com/morbidology and click Begin Visit and then use the code Morbidology at sign up, and you'll get your first visit for only $5. That's apostrophe.com/morbidology and use the code Morbidology to get your dermatologist craft a treatment plan for $5. And big thank you to Apostrophe for sponsoring Morbidology. A couple of days after the funeral was held, a grand jury would indict Thomas on 18 felony charges, including first degree murder, kidnapping, child abuse, tampering with evidence, and conspiracy. He had originally been charged with child abuse resulting in death. The search warrants relating to the murder would be released, and they revealed some more gruesome information about Jeremiah's death. His autopsy revealed lacerations that were consistent with sexual assault. Portions of his body had also been burned. Thomas would subsequently plead not guilty to all of the charges he was facing. Shortly thereafter, Tracy would be indicted on 12 counts, including 2 counts of child abuse, 3 counts of tampering with evidence, 6 counts of conspiracy to tamper with evidence, and 1 count of obstructing an investigation of child abuse or neglect. Jordan would be next, and he would be indicted on 13 counts, including 1 count of child abuse resulting in death, 5 counts of tampering with evidence, 6 counts of conspiracy to tamper with evidence, and 1 count of obstructing the reporting or investigation of child abuse or neglect. With the charges handed down, the Children, Youth and Families Department would announce they had already taken a number of steps to strengthen the child protection system. They were now offering hands-on training for police officers on how to use their new web portal that gave quick access to information on troubled families. This would include details on custody disputes, allegations of abuse or neglect, as well as concerns about drugs and violence. They had also started campaigns at schools that would raise awareness among the staff members of signs of abuse within pupils and how to report any concerns that they may have. In early April, Thomas was in court again, where he was to be sentenced for violating probation in the 2014 domestic violence case. It was long overdue. His victim in this case, Amanda, would tell Judge Glenn Ellington about the years of abuse she had sustained while in a relationship with Thomas. She said, "I was with a demon. There was no escape." She said that he physically and sexually abused her for years and isolated her from all of her friends and family. Thomas would be sentenced to almost 6 years in prison. It was a very bittersweet moment because it just showed that Thomas should have been behind bars at the time of Jeremiah's murder. A new search warrant release would suggest that Jordan had a more active role in Jeremiah's murder than initially believed. Investigators had been able to obtain Facebook messages that had been sent before Jeremiah's body was found. And in one, Jordan had wrote that he felt as though people were looking at him differently, like he had done it all by himself. He goes on to state that what he had done was just an accident. The message read, "I'm just unwanted here, and that's cool, but I can see it in your eyes, and Tracy's eyes. Y'all don't want me here ever since that shit happened. And they look at me like I did it all by myself. They did it too, and what I did was an accident. I never meant to do that. I miss that little fucker too. I feel bad for what I did, and if I could do things different, I would, but I can't. I have nightmares and shit. I think about that kid every day, because I looked into his eyes as he left. I see that look every day." After the release of the new search warrant, Jordan would plead not guilty, and just a couple of days later, there was a massive update in the case. On the 26th of April, just 3 months after the arrests, Thomas was found dead in his jail cell. He was found by a guard at 11:15 p.m, hanging from a bedsheet in his jail cell. Attempts to resuscitate him were unsuccessful, and he was pronounced dead by the state office and the medical examiner. His suicide had come just as he was about to be transferred to a state-run prison to begin serving his 6-year sentence for violating his probation. He would be at the prison while awaiting trial for the murder of Jeremiah. District Attorney Mark O'Cerna said that he was angry about his death, stating, "I don't believe Ferguson is going to receive the full justice my office was going to bring against him, to bring justice to Jeremiah, the family, and the people of northern New Mexico." Thomas's defense lawyer, Michael Jones, would state that he wanted his suicide investigated, adding that he hoped county officials would hold the jail accountable if needs be. He said that the Santa Fe, New Mexican, "The jail has a responsibility to all inmates to ensure they are safe, regardless of what they are charged with." County Communications Coordinator Christine Mihalik was stating in a release that staff at the jail address mental health issues and suicide prevention, but said that their efforts cannot guarantee that inmates won't try to harm themselves. It read in part, "Despite the best of intentions and practices with respect to suicide prevention, occasionally an individual who decides to self-harm within a detention and correctional facility will commit self-harm." Thomas had actually left behind a suicide note in which he professed his innocence in the murder of Jeremiah and expressed his hatred for law enforcement and the judicial system. He also wrote personal messages to family members, but it was not disclosed what those messages were. There was also writing on one of the walls which read, "I died here, along with born 10-4-75, died 11-26-17. He had also written on the desk, "I love my son, Jordan." Around 2 months before his suicide, he had also attempted to send a letter to Tracy, which read, "I really do want you to know, baby, that I am not the one who did this, and that I am truly sorry for your loss. It was my loss too, because I really do love you all so very much." Another portion of the letter referenced Jordan. It read in part, "I know for sure bringing him down here was a big mistake. Don't get me wrong, I love him too, but all he's done since his being here was caused a lot of problems between all of us, and it cost me our family. I ain't mad at you, and I still love you very, very much. I swear to God I do. I don't think you feel the same way about me anymore, because I'm sure he's blaming me for what he did." A further search warrant would be released in July, and it revealed that Jeremiah had actually reached out to a family member over Facebook to report that he was being abused by Tracy and Thomas. The female relative would express concern over Jeremiah and his sister, and Tracy would respond by stating that Jeremiah was a manipulative liar. The female relative simply ended the conversation there instead of going to police. The following month, Jeremiah's cause of death would finally be publicized. He had died from blunt force trauma, and his autopsy noted numerous old and new injuries that were consistent with being beaten and tortured in the lead-up to his murder. The autopsy report also said that there was no conclusive evidence that Jeremiah had been sexually assaulted. However, it could also not be ruled out. Jeremiah had sustained multiple jaw fractures, a displaced eyeball, tears in his scalp, cheek, and ear, as well as a broken hand and broken ribs. The medical examination had been hampered due to the fact that Jeremiah was heavily decomposed by the time his body was found. The toxicology report would be just as disturbing. It revealed that when Jeremiah died, he had alcohol and methamphetamine in his system. District Attorney Mark O'Cerna stated, "Unfortunately, it's not surprising given what this poor kid had to go through in that house." He announced that they would need to be investigating this to see if further charges needed to be filed. Methamphetamine was the drug of choice for Tracy, as well as Thomas. In September, it was disclosed the prosecutors now speculated that it was actually Jordan, not Thomas, who had killed Jeremiah. According to new court documents that were filed, Jordan had repeatedly tortured Jeremiah with a homemade spear, as well as a button-controlled shock collar. Even more disturbing, they also believed that Jeremiah's younger sister may have been forced to take part in the torture. According to investigators, they had found more evidence on Jordan's Facebook, in which he bragged in messages that he took someone off the map and did some dirt. It would be revealed that Jeremiah's sister had actually told investigators that Jordan tortured Jeremiah on a daily basis for at least a month. He would stab him with a homemade spear and would constantly shock him with the collar. Nevertheless, Jordan would still be fighting for bail, and towards the end of September, he would appear in court where Jeremiah's younger sister would testify about the horrors that transpired at the home. Speaking of Thomas, she said, "It was hard. It was not fun. He was always angry and was always being mean to everyone in the house. He would take his anger out on all of us. He would hit us or hit the dogs." She detailed the day that Jeremiah died.
"Yeah, my mother was getting mad at Jeremiah, and so he put him in the dog cage in the living room. And he was really skinny, and he had, all his cuts were infected. He started to flip the cage, and I told him to sleep him alone, and he didn't. And then he pulled him out, and, his head is just kind of dangling."
She said that she and Thomas were planning to pick her mother up from jail when Thomas locked Jeremiah in the dog kennel. She said that Jeremiah eventually fell asleep, but Jordan began flipping the kennel to wake him up. She said that Jordan then pulled Jeremiah out of the kennel, and she described how his head was dangling and he never woke up. Speaking of her brother's appearance on that day, she said, "He was really skinny and all of his cuts were infected. He had a black eye, and his tooth was knocked out." She said she had previously been forced to watch as Thomas poked Jeremiah with a spear.
"Jordan poked Jeremiah with the spear."
"Yeah."
She went on to say that Thomas forced her mother to abuse her son when he didn't feel like doing it. She said, "He would just tell me to do it. I was too afraid to tell him no." Amanda Nunez, Jordan's mother, would also testify. She said that she had married Thomas when she was 14 years old and had stayed with him for 16 years. She said, "He was abusive and I was an obsession. I wasn't even a person. I was just his thing he liked to beat on. When we had kids, it got even worse. It wasn't something I could stop." She said that she had 3 miscarriages because Thomas had beaten her so badly, adding that he left her for dead on several occasions. Speaking of her son Jordan, she said that Thomas didn't believe that he was his son because of his skin tone and that he had punched Jordan when he was just 2 months old. She testified, "He said he wished the little son of a bitch would die. Amanda also said that Thomas would force Jordan and his other siblings to hit one another, and he tried to force her to hit the children too, but she refused, which always resulted in more beatings for her. Judge Wilson would acknowledge that Jordan had been controlled and manipulated by his father, but he said that Jordan was still a threat to the community and ordered that he remain behind bars. In November, a vigil was held for Jeremiah. It had been around a year since he was murdered. A number of his loved ones, as well as other members of the community, would gather at Frenchie's Field in the west side of Santa Fe to reminisce about Jeremiah. There were a number of photographs of Jeremiah in happier times, and his aunt, Selena Miera, said, "I just want people to remember Jeremiah the boy, not the way he died. He was a person. He had his whole life ahead of him, and it was just taken away." Jeremiah's half-sister, Karen Gonzalez, described him as being very sweet and very helpful, adding that he certainly wasn't shy and would just go up and introduce himself to people in his search for friends. The photographs of Jeremiah were attached to the windshield of two cars, alongside some blue and yellow balloons that had the Batman logo on the front. Jeremiah had loved Batman. Towards the end of November, it was announced that Tracy had accepted a plea deal. In court, District Attorney Cerna said, "As we continued to flesh out information during this case, it was brought to our attention that at times, Tracy was kept drugged by Mr. Ferguson and was also beaten herself." He said that under the law, Tracy was required to speak up about the abuse that was being inflicted on her son, but also said that Tracy was willing to take responsibility. Deputy District Attorney Todd Bullion told the courtroom that Tracy had first of all met Thomas when he was selling her narcotics. As soon as the relationship began, Thomas was abusing her. It was revealed that he forced her to stay in the home and even watched her with surveillance that he had set up. As part of the plea deal, Tracy pleaded guilty to one count of child abuse resulting in death and three counts of conspiracy to traffic methamphetamine. The other charges against her were dismissed. Her pleas would have carried a 21-year prison sentence, but prosecutors suspended 9 of those years under the condition that Tracy help in the prosecution of Jordan. This meant that Tracy would be sentenced to just 12 years in prison. Outside of court, her mother, Teresa Tapia, said, "I think it was pretty fair under the circumstances. Tracy was a victim, and they all knew she was. She didn't know what kind of man Ferguson was. I know she loves her children, and I know Jeremiah loved his mother." In March of the following year, it was announced that a bill had been created to track students moving between public school districts. The bill had been inspired by the tragic murder of Jeremiah. He had essentially fallen off the education system's radar when his family moved from Las Vegas to Santa Fe. House Bill 447 passed the Senate 23-17, which meant that it would now be heading to the governor's desk. With the case against Jordan proceeding, it soon became apparent that his defense were going to be arguing that he was mentally ill and unable to form the specific intent to commit the crimes. His defense lawyer, Mark Ernest, filed a notion of his intent of such, but he didn't specify what condition would have prevented Jordan from forming intent. His defense team were also wanting to access family history and were investigating whether Jordan had been abused by his father while growing up. They were also wanting to explore the impact that childhood abuse could have had on Jordan. Some additional charges would subsequently be filed against Jordan. There were 7 more counts of child abuse. In the indictment, Jordan was accused of flipping over the dog kennel that Jeremiah was locked in, forcefully striking him in the genitals, forcing him to consume methamphetamine, striking him with a spear, using a shock collar on him, and holding him in a fireplace. A wrongful death lawsuit would be filed in Jeremiah's name, and an attorney representing his state would state that Jeremiah would still be alive if state, city, and county officials had not failed him. Attorney Francis Carpenter wrote in the wrongful death complaint, "This case presents a tragedy that resulted from a toxic blend of apathy, understaffing, negligent operation of a building and equipment, bad police training and supervision, investigation and follow-up, and systematic failures by the agencies whose purpose it is to provide for public safety. The defendants named in the lawsuit were the Santa Fe County Commission, the Sheriff's Department, the City of Santa Fe, and two of its police officers, as well as District Attorney Marco Serna and Deputy District Attorney Michael Nunez. The lawsuit was seeking unspecified damages on behalf of Jeremiah's sister. Santa Fe would agree to pay $25,000 to settle the wrongful death lawsuit. The murder trial of Jordan was scheduled for mid-2020, but in March, it was announced that he too had accepted a plea deal, much like Tracy. He pleaded guilty to recklessly allowing the abuse of Jeremiah and two counts of tampering with evidence.
Jordan says he rattled the cage. AV says he flipped it. But regardless, their own statements, that is also corroborated by the DNA evidence, shows that Jeremiah was in that kennel, and that's likely where he took his final breath.
Jordan's sentencing phase would follow, but not before Tracy was to be formally sentenced. Victim impact statements were allowed from the family, and Jeremiah's aunt, Celine, asked the judge to impose the maximum sentence. She said that she had been trying to find Jeremiah and his sister for several months in the fall of 2017, but couldn't find the family anywhere. She said, "How in the world could a mother let someone beat, torture, and kill her son?" She had gone to police to try and get them to help her find them, but by the time they took any interest, Jeremiah was already dead. Tracy was sentenced to 21 years in prison with 9 years suspended, which meant that she would be serving just 12 years. She refused to make a statement. She didn't explain herself and she didn't apologize. Jordan's sentencing phase would be next. His defense were wanting to argue for the lowest sentence possible, which would be 14 years, while the prosecution was arguing for the strictest, which would be 22 years. During the sentencing phase, graphic photographs of Jeremiah's body were displayed. District Attorney Mary Carmack Altwees argued that the severity of the injuries inflicted on Jeremiah indicated that the abuse was a serious violent offense, which would require Jordan to serve at least 85% of his sentence before being considered for parole. She said, "Tommy was the bad guy in all of this while Jordan watched. But that's the problem. Jordan watched and occasionally participated. He got the benefit of a plea bargain because of his lesser involvement. But even though it was lesser, it was not less. It still resulted in Jeremiah's death." She presented the homemade spear, a sledgehammer, and a dog kennel, all of which had been tested positive for Jeremiah's blood. Crime scene photographs also showed that blood was found in every single room in the family's home. Defense Ernest argued that Jordan did not commit a serious offense and argued for a reduced sentence. He cited the fact that Jordan had been abused as a child at the hands of Thomas. He also said that Jordan felt remorse for what he had done to Jeremiah, and that should have been taken into consideration. Mental health experts, however, would give contradictory testimony about the impact his traumatic childhood had on his ability to resist participating in the fatal beating. Dr. Jeffrey Rowe, who was testifying for the defense, said that Jordan had post-traumatic stress disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder that was brought on by an abusive and neglectful childhood. Jordan had been in state custody from 6 years old to 9 years old, which he said had stunted his cognitive abilities and made it impossible to stand up to his father. The prosecution witness, Dr. David Salzberg, disputed the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. He said that while Jordan reported some flashbacks from his childhood abuse, he didn't claim to have experienced persistent and intrusive thoughts of the abuse. He said that Jordan had stood up to his father before and had argued with him, adding that he was even in a better position than Tracy to leave and get help. Before being sentenced, Jordan would speak to the courtroom. He said, "I hope that moving down here to get to know my father and forgive him would help me to get to know myself better and help me fix what felt broken inside. I want you to know that I'm truly sorry for my failure to call 911. That's a fact I'm going to have to live with for the rest of my life." Jeremiah's aunt, Celine, would reject the apology, stating that it sounded rehearsed and insincere. Jordan would ultimately be sentenced to 21 years in prison. In handing down the sentence, Judge Wilson said that Jordan had seen Jeremiah in a wheelchair and hobbling on a cane with extreme injuries. But despite this, he never did anything to stop the abuse. The grim murder of Jeremiah Valencia led to many questions about the probation system and the revolving door of jail. Time and time again, Thomas Ferguson had committed extremely violent crimes, but each time, he was let go with very little more than a slap on the wrist. While Jeremiah had been abused at the home by Thomas, it was when Thomas's son, Jordan Nunez, moved in that things for young Jeremiah took an even more tragic turn. A turn that would result in him dying alone in a dog kennel. While Jeremiah lost his life to child abuse, his death was not in vain. And in the aftermath, a number of changes were made. Changes that will hopefully protect more of New Mexico's children. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Sunset987 and Lisa. I am eternally grateful for all of the support up on Patreon. And if you join, I send out a handwritten thank you card, as well as some cool exclusive merch. I also upload exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, ad-free and early release episodes, and bonus audio and case files. Just search Morbidology on the Patreon app or website, and you can join for as little as $1 a month. There's absolutely no obligations, and you can cancel any time. Morbidology is a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon really goes such a long way. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.